From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Sydney Kidd, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Kyle Fontensteel, reporter for Idaho Capital Sun, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports. I want to welcome all of you to the show. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
We did it.
Happy Friday.
Yeah, we did it. We got to Friday. Okay, I want to begin today with the Idaho GOP convention, which was held up in North Idaho over the weekend. So, Logan, can we start with the fact that for most of the convention, news media wasn't allowed inside, but there was a part you were able to finally cover?
Yes, this was the Idaho Republican Party's biannual convention. This is a thing the major political parties in Idaho do every 2 years. It's where they reelect elect new officers for the party. So that's the party chair and vice chairs, treasurer, secretary, that sort of thing. At this convention, they also consider changes to their platform as well as resolutions from the party. So that would be directing the party to take certain actions, pursue lawsuits, that type of thing. And yes, this year it was held up at Coeur d'Alene. It was held part of it at the Coeur d'Alene Resort and then the second half at North Idaho College. And the media was not allowed into the first two and a half days of the proceedings, which from my understanding from other journalists who I've talked to is a bit of a departure from past precedent. In the past, the meetings have been open to anybody who wanted to attend them, so you could hear the debates within the party about the changes to the platform and the resolutions and all of those sort of things. And we were finally allowed to enter the convention floor for the officer nominations and speeches and voting process that happened Saturday evening. So that was kind of the very last piece of the convention we were allowed into to observe.
Okay. And then, Logan, I know that Dorothy Moon won re-election as the head of the GOP during the convention. A lot of her detractors have called her things like being on the fringe. I mean, she's even at times been called a leader of a cult. So did she address any of these claims during her acceptance speech?
She addressed them pretty directly. Yeah, I think you're referencing a part of my story that is actually, it's not a direct quote from her, but checking back on my notes here, the direct quote from her candidacy speech was, "Some people in this room have called me the leader of a cult. You're my cult, though, so that's okay." And that got a pretty big cheer from the crowd of convention delegates that went on to re-elect her as chairwoman and to install a full slate of party officers aligned with her by about a 30-point margin, which is kind of notable in and of itself. If we look back at the last several conventions, for example, when Moon unseated the past party chair, Tom Luna, as well as I believe when, I don't remember if it was Luna v. Labrador the time before that or when Labrador ran that first time, but oftentimes at these conventions, these chairmanship and leadership races come down to really slim margins. I can remember multiple times where it's been like 1 or 2% one way or the other. This was a 30-point spread. The convention pretty resoundingly elected a full slate of officers that are aligned with Moon and her allies in the party.
Logan, after that, I mean, about, you know, I'm looking at your article right now that you wrote, and a quote that Moon said was, quote, "We are not the fringe folks, for some of you in here who think we are." And I think that to your point of how much she won, you know, re-election, kind of what was the I don't want to say follow-up, but what was the reaction to her, you know, saying that?
Folks were pretty, the folks who were there supporting her were full throated in support of her. The folks who were there and more critical of Moon, the numbers were smaller, but they were no less passionate. I talked to a lot of folks who said they don't recognize the Republican Party that they've come up in, who said they, are just kind of, yeah, I heard a lot of folks who were uncomfortable, I guess I'll say, with the direction of the party, but also a little bit baffled at the, we'll call the more establishment or more traditional parts of the party to kind of combat this. There was, so Moon, for context, ran for chair of the party. She was challenged by Mary Souza, who's a former state senator, who also, she and Moon ran in a three-way primary for Secretary of State most recently, and lost to Secretary McGrane. But I heard some folks who came to the convention specifically with the goal in mind of voting for Mary Souza and the people who were going to be aligned with her and trying to kick out Dorothy Moon, and they simply didn't have the numbers to do that. But some of the folks there said, I know we've got Mary Souza lined up for chair, but I don't know who our candidates are for any of these other races. And I kind of got the impression that the more traditional faction of the party was not as organized coming into this as they would have liked to have been.
All right. Well, appreciate that. So, Kyle, there's a fairly new business system the state of Idaho is using, and it seems to be missing some crucial data and security controls. But before we get into all of that, can you tell us what this system is? It's called LUMA, correct?
Yes. So, LUMA is a massive system that brings together all of the state's business, budget, procurement, payroll, and other services for all state employees at all state agencies. State officials launched it last July. It's based in the Idaho State's Controller's Office, and they say that LUMA is the biggest reengineering of business system in Idaho's histories, and they also say that LUMA replaced what they say were outdated and vulnerable systems.
Okay, so with that said, Kyle, LUMA launched about a year ago, and my understanding from your reporting is that there was an audit done, and then the results of this audit were given to legislators this week. And what so what happened there? Like, what did this audit find?
Yeah, so Idaho contracted out for two audits from a private firm, a global accounting firm named Baker Tilly, and those audits generally found that LUMA lacked a range of technology controls for data validation and security. They highlighted a few issues with LUMA, some of which the Idaho Capital Sun has previously reported. There are issues with interest allocation to state agencies, payment delays from the state and duplicated Medicaid payments. And just to be clear, a state auditor expects the state's controller's office will submit reform plans following the audits. But I'll get into a little bit of what we already knew about LUMA's problems. So last July, when the state went live with LUMA, less than 50% of the state's employees had completed basic training on it. In November, we also reported that Idaho double paid more than $32 million in Idaho Department of Health and Welfare payments after the payments were duplicated. And we also talked to an Eastern Idaho nonprofit called the Idaho Park Sustainable Fire Community that said it wasn't paid for months that it completed through state grants. But after it complained to state legislators and journalists, the nonprofit said it began receiving payments. And then in February, we reported that Idaho wasn't able to distribute more than $100 million in interest payment to state agencies. And we have more about this in our story as well.
So what's next then for this, Kyle? I mean, what happens now? Because I'm assuming you can't just get rid of this entire new system. I would assume you have to try to fix it.
I don't know a ton about what's next. The state auditor said she expects corrective action plans from the controller's office following the audit. Those typically outline how the agency would respond to issues that critical audits found. And I imagine there will be a broader review, but I don't know what's next.
Okay, appreciate that update, though. Sydney, let me bring you into the conversation. So if anyone has been around the campus of College of Western Idaho in Nampa recently, they've probably noticed a really big kind of metal structure going up. So what is that? What's going on the campus there?
Yeah, so the College of Western Idaho's Nampa campus is growing. That big metal structure that you see when you're driving out there is going to be their new health and science building. But they're also working on another expansion project on the same campus for it'll be a horticulture and agricultural science building, or space rather. And yeah, they're pretty it's pretty interesting just to see this college growing. The health and science building, when it's complete, will be 60,000 square feet.
Wow.
10,000 of that will be unfinished space, so they'll be able to grow into that as the college continues to grow. But yeah, it's going to service its dental assisting program, surgical technician program, nursing program, microbiological science program, and its biology program. So big space.
Mm-hmm. And I may have missed you saying this, but when are they expecting it to be open and up and running?
So that building will be open in the fall of 2025. The Horticulture and Agricultural Science Center will also be open in the fall of 2025. And that that center is going to sit on about 40 acres of land.
And it's interesting too, Sydney, as you said, it'll house so many things, in particular their nursing program, their surgical tech program, their dental assistant program. And these are programs that we've seen really expanding at CWI over the last few years and really filling gaps in the Treasure Valley.
Yeah, it's interesting to get to watch these colleges grow, because obviously we have the state universities like Boise State, like Idaho State, mm-hmm. and U of I. But it's these colleges definitely serve other students that maybe don't have the opportunity to go to university yet, right? Or maybe mm-hmm. this is what they've chosen to do with an associate's degree. And so it's fun to watch other just different demographics of students getting to be served in more expanded ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is officially the first day of summer. So, Christina, that brings us to issues of wildfire as well as snowpack. And my understanding is that earlier this week, the Bureau of Land Management and the Idaho Department of Lands gave their fire forecast briefing. So can you talk to us about what they are expecting to see this season?
Yes. So those agencies briefed the Idaho State Board of Land Commissioners. And at the meeting, one of the BLM meteorologists said that the east central Idaho near Salmon and southern parts of the Idaho Panhandle are the areas in our state that are going to be most vulnerable to wildfire this summer. That's due to several factors, including low snowpack in those regions, and mm-hmm. the dry summer conditions that are forecasted there will put those areas at higher risk. And then another factor that might contribute to our risk this year is that Idaho officials have observed abnormal fine fuel loading, which means there are a lot of natural plants growing, such as cheatgrass and sage, that are highly flammable and could contribute to the spread of wildfires, especially later in the summer season. As of Tuesday morning, the Idaho Department of Lands has counted 50 fires already in Idaho this
really?
Year, although wow. the affected acreage of that has been pretty small at 58 acres. So we're already seeing some of this stuff pop up. And obviously, as conditions continue to dry out, we'll see more fire activity and things like that. But I think it's really important to note that of those 50 fires so far this year, 27 were human-caused fires. We did a lot of reporting last year at the Idaho Capital Sun about human-caused fires, and mm-hmm. most of these are very unintentional, but the problem is that human-caused fires can really tie up important firefighting resources. It can spread our firefighters really thin. Y'all at Boise State Public Radio had a good story this week on how Idaho is struggling to retain some of those experienced firefighters, like engine bosses. and specifically like the incident commanders that are in charge of the fire response due to like low pay and other factors. So we really have tried to highlight some tips to keep safe, some FireWise tips that, you know, some of the fire officials continually put out, especially as they see these upticks in these human caused fires. So, you know, you never want to leave a campfire unattended. You want to make sure it's completely out before you leave the area. You need to be cognizant of where you're smoking or what you're doing with like your cigarette butts and things like that. And even making sure your trailers and other things that you're towing are properly hooked up to your vehicle so that the chains don't drag and spark and start a fire. I think we've all reported on, you know, human caused fires that really could have been prevented. And it's frustrating to see when our resources are spread really thin. So I would just say like anyone listening, you know, these are all important things to keep in mind so we don't experience those unnecessary costs or danger to our firefighters or to structures and towns this fire season. I think Idaho's been pretty lucky the last few fire seasons, but you know, I always have that feeling of like we're kind of due for a bad one, and there are things we can do to help prevent those.
You know, Christina, it's interesting that you said that, right? That we're kind of due for a bad one. And you don't, I mean, you hope that that doesn't happen, but
right.
I think, you know, we've all lived here a long time. I've been here a long time. I've covered some really, really huge fire seasons, you know, in the West in general, but in Idaho. And we have been really lucky these last couple of years. And I know you've got some statistics even in your latest story about, you know, 2021, 22, and 23. And I mean, the last 2 years, we had less fires than we did in 2021, but that seems to be kind of unusual. So I'm curious,
right,
when they gave this fire forecast, did they have any predictions about, you know, this could be a bad fire season? I mean, we need to be prepared for that. But at the same time, I think it's always difficult to know who's going to catch a bad fire season. It will happen
right
somewhere.
And it feels like different parts of the country experience this. Like New Mexico right now is experiencing extremely hardcore wildfires, and they're merging, and that's really scary, you know, and they've lost people and all sorts of structures and things like that. One of the things that the director of the Idaho Department of Lands, Dustin Miller, said during the meeting was that it really aims to be efficient in its, you know, its calculations and things like that, but it is just a question mark. It's unknown. So right now the state has $68 million allocated for fire suppression in the general fund. But, you know, Miller really emphasized that that's only an estimate. We may need more if there's worse fires than what we're anticipating. Last year, the department spent $17 million on fire suppression.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in 2021, during that particularly severe fire season that you talked about, the costs were $75 million. So it really fluctuates. He talked about that, you know, this agency is constantly thinking about the what the taxpayers will have to pay for this sort of thing. And then as we're talking about, you know, that's just for the state of Idaho. Those funds are for the
right
state of Idaho. But sometimes our firefighters are called to help other Western states fight fires. And so if we have bad fire seasons in New Mexico, there are less, you know, we're sending Idaho firefighters to cover those fires there. But that might mean less firefighters here. It's all this kind of puzzle piece game that they have to play to try to address these wildfires. And again, if most of these, the majority of these, are coming from humans and human caused accidents, I think it's upon us to really consider what we can be doing to help our firefighters out so that they're not, you know, trying to be in all places at once during the summertime.
And I think too, sometimes it's difficult, like when we're sitting here and it's June and it's beautiful out, right? And because with Idaho, you know, historically, at least, it seems like we hit about, you know, mid to the end of July, maybe early August, and then we start to see a fire season. Are they concerned about that as well? Because I think sometimes then it's not top of mind, right, to do
right
all of the fire suppression things that you just talked about.
I think I've heard fire officials really talk about how we're moving from a fire season to fire years, that the fire seasons tend to be longer. They can go well into September and even October if there's really bad fires and terrain that they can't easily get firefighters to. I think we all should be thinking about the 4th of July coming up and how we're lighting off fireworks and things like that, especially in public lands, which in most places it's illegal to do that. So, I think these are all top of mind for fire officials and things like that. But some of the feedback that I've seen is that they genuinely worry about the elongation of these fire seasons. And like you're saying, right now, we have good weather. Things are still green out there. The vegetation hasn't really turned to that dry fuel load that they talked about. It can really take off. Fires can merge, things like that. It does sound like that they're having some trouble hiring experienced firefighters for this work. So I think it's, like I said, just incumbent upon all of us to be thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm. And here's my public service announcement, as you brought up the 4th of July. It's like, folks, don't go buy illegal fireworks. Don't go shoot them off in the foothills. Don't shoot them off in public lands. I mean, these are simple things that honestly is upon all of us to make sure that we don't start these types of fires.
Right. We're in a community that does amazing fireworks show. I'm from Eastern Idaho, where they do, the biggest show in Idaho there. And I just think there's like opportunities to do it safely and still have a lot of fun with your family without starting fires that could affect your home or your neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kyle, you've written a series that's out right now, and it's about the Idaho Behavioral Health Plan contract. So before we dive into your reporting on this, can you tell us what this plan is and the contract?
I'd be happy to. So the Idaho Behavioral Health Plan is a big contract for a private company to run Medicaid mental health benefits for Idahoans on Medicaid. They're around like 400,000 Idahoans on Medicaid that would be affected by this contract. It's also Idaho state government's largest contract at $1.2 billion. It takes effect July 1, switching over to a new contractor for the first time in a decade. It's drawn lawsuits from losing companies, and including the company that's ran it for a decade. When that company first rolled out the contract in 2013, it was sort of a rocky rollout. There were several reports that Optum had delayed payments to providers, but now it's switching over to a new contractor, Magellan of Idaho, part of a national company, Centene, that also is part of running Medicaid benefits in several other states. One big difference in the new contract compared to the old contract is that Magellan will now have to manage both inpatient care, like hospitalizations, and outpatient care, like therapy visits. Optum didn't handle inpatient care. That was up to the state of Idaho. But but before we get into like what this means for providers and a little bit more about the contract, I just wanted to zoom out about a broader conversation that state policymakers are having around this contract and other contracts. So state lawmakers spent a lot of time last year and part of this legislative session talking about like how Medicaid should be run. A lot of Republican lawmakers are concerned about rising costs of Idaho Medicaid, which is the largest state government program, and they spent a lot of time considering how you can restructure the program to try to save costs or be more efficient. And one option that folks are looking at that's really popular across the country is called managed care. That's mm-hmm. when a private company is contracted out by the state to manage mental health benefits. Like in this case, Idaho does a mix of that kind of care, managed care, and Idaho also does manage its own Medicaid sets of Medicaid benefits. That's often called a fee for service model. But we also have this kind of unique model called value-based care, where medical providers like clinics manage healthcare benefits, and what that looks like is that private companies or the state will whoever's running managing Medicaid benefits, they'll approve specific care for people through prior authorization requests let a company or the state decide if this is medically necessary, and talking with doctors and doctors talking with patients. And then whoever runs the Medicaid benefits also set the reimbursement rate for providers, so how much they get paid for service, and they're also tasked with actually making those payments to providers. So state lawmakers spent a lot of time discussing this, but they didn't decide if switching to managed care is the right move just yet.
Okay, so speaking of payments, in the first part of your series, Kyle, you really focused on this aspect of it, because you looked into some concerns that some healthcare providers are having in regards to payments possibly being delayed. So can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah. So that was one of two main concerns we talked with providers about for our story. And providers are concerned about delayed payments for a couple of reasons. I guess first, many of them remember the Rocky contract rollout in 2013 when Optum delayed payments to providers. They were sending much smaller payments than providers expected to provide services. And I'd heard that that providers took out loans to stay afloat while they waited for these payments to be complete. And then I guess the second main reason that folks are concerned that payments might be delayed again now under Magellan is that they say there are technical issues testing Magellan's payment system. One provider leader told me that Magellan's tests are only partial, they're not a full test of medical claims payments. And she says she didn't know a provider that had been able to fully test the system yet. And behind this, they worry that providers are in a worse financial position now than they were in 2013. They don't have as much cash flow to be able to handle delayed payments, and several providers told me they're worried that they and other providers could close if payments are delayed, and they're especially worried about smaller providers who don't have to process as many claims or don't have as much access to high technology. But I also should say that a provider lobbyist said that Magellan, the company taking over the contract, and the state health department have been hyper responsive to provider concerns lately, and state officials and Magellan officials have tried to reassure providers who are worried about these delayed payments. They say that Magellan's payment tests are on track, and that providers have successfully tested the payment system, and that officials are prepared to be available to help quickly for any issues that pop up.
Okay, we will get to the other half of your series on this a little bit later on in the program, but appreciate that part of this series, Kyle. So Sydney, talk to us about this area of Boise that's kind of Boise, but kind of not Boise, because it sits in the city's area of impact. It houses like 30 some thousand people. So first, can you tell us where this area is and why does it matter that it's in Boise's area of impact?
Yeah, so the area that you're referring to is in the Southwest. It sits between just roughly about Cloverdale Road to like part of Cole Road. And then from south of Victory Road to about Columbia. Okay. And it's in the area of impact for Boise, but unlike a lot of other municipalities in the area, this area of impact is completely built out, where others might have a lot more like empty fields, room for developing. This one's pretty much got all of its neighborhoods in.
So why is that then important, Sydney, for folks to understand? Because it's, I would assume, since it's built out like this, they use certain services, right? But they're not annexed into the city.
Yeah, so some parts of this area of impact are connected to the city sewer system. They pay the city for sewer services. They started doing this in the 1970s when certain parts of the area's septic systems began to fail, and the county requested help from the city. So the city spent money to get them hooked up to City Sewer Services, but they have yet to be annexed into the city. So while they do have these services, well, mostly sewer, they also, like, they don't pay city property tax. They can't vote in city elections. And so you're right. It's like Boise, but it's not Boise.
Yeah. Okay. So the city of Boise, though, my understanding is they are now looking once again, because this has come up in the past, to annex this area. So A, how is that progressing? And B, will it likely happen, or are they getting pushback?
Yeah. So there, I don't know that I would say that they're looking to annex it in.
Okay.
But it's a topic that comes up at city council quite frequently, just like a little bit flippantly. We saw conversations of it really fire up during the discussions about what to do with the McGurdio Park site. And then it'll come up occasionally here and there. And so what happened this week was at the city council's work session, lots of officials from different departments in Boise came and gave presentations to the city council members, especially because there are some new city council members, and the history of this huge chunk of land is decades long. And so these officials just came in and kind of talked about, okay, if we were to annex this in, like, you know, here's what it would look like. Here's what we would have to do. Here are the costs of it. And the costs are like crazy. I think that the city said that if they were to annex this in, that it would put them like in the hole by about $100 million.
Wow. Okay, so yeah. Likelihood may not be there then for an annexation. So, Logan, as we talked about in the first part of the show, the Idaho GOP convention was held last weekend, and not only did they reelect Dorothy Moon as their chair, but they also adopted their platform changes for the next 2 years. So tell us about what these changes are.
Sure, yeah. The Idaho Republican Party platform is a living document that the party amends at these conventions every 2 years. Kind of the one of the ones that got the most attention from us in the media, and of course people reading our stories, has to do with the right to life plank of the platform, which is traditionally the anti-abortion stance in the Idaho Republican Party platform. And they did the advocates of this amendment said they were strengthening this by expanding the platform. Now, after the convention, reads, "We oppose all actions which intentionally end an innocent human life, including abortion, all destruction of human embryos, euthanasia, and assisted suicide." So it's covering more things than just the abortion arena. And honing in on that, it talks about the destruction of human embryos, which is something that is related to IVF or in vitro fertilization, which is a procedure where embryos are created in a lab and then implanted into the uterus. And so this procedure sometimes ends up in extra embryos being produced. And this is kind of the new frontier in the post-Dobbs world where states are able to regulate abortion. We saw recently where I don't remember which state it was. It might have been Alabama, but there was a period where of the state Supreme Courts had ruled that frozen embryos at an IVF clinic had all the same legal rights as a child for all other purposes of the law. And we saw kind of some movement during the legislative session here in Idaho where some lawmakers wanted to replace the term embryo or fetus with preborn child throughout state statute. So the party platform doesn't say anything specific about IVF, but it does say they're opposed to the destruction of human embryos, which I know has some people's eyebrows raised.
Well, I think it's fascinating, Logan, because you mentioned Alabama, right, with that whole thing. And then you have the Southern Baptist Church, which is one of the largest factions of the Protestant church in the country, coming out basically saying the same thing and really going after IVF and saying that they don't agree with it. So we'll have to, I guess, wait and see, right, over the next 2 years, what this verbiage for the GOP platform really will mean and look like, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I'm talking to Republicans, the thing I hear from them, by and large, most of the Republican folks who I talk to in Idaho are not opposed to IVF, but they are very strong in their pro-life convictions. And their view is that once these eggs are fertilized and an embryo is formed, that is a human life and it shouldn't just be discarded. And the state, in their eyes, has a role in protecting those innocent lives.
Mm-hmm. Changing topics completely, Christina, the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory's annual report just came out. First, can you tell us what exactly this report is? Because it's quite popular with your readers.
It is. Every time we run one of these columns, it's one of our most popular columns of the year. So every year, I think since 2017, the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory puts out this great annual report that tracks all kinds of, like, I'm talking real nerd stuff here. Geological activity around the national park. It records things like how many individual earthquakes the park had, how many earthquake swarms it had, how many times the geysers went off, and then it compares that to all of the previous years. So it's just a treasure trove. It, like, does it records thermal activity and the energy that the thermal geysers produce. Like, it's, and there's all these graphs, and it's wonderful to look at. I think we all have a special place in our hearts for Yellowstone, and so if you're interested in some of this stuff, it's a great thing to check out.
Okay, so what did the report find this year?
Yes. So this year, or in 20, we're talking about 2023, okay. There were 1,623 individual earthquakes recorded in the national park and the surrounding area, which seems like a lot, but it was actually 800 fewer earthquakes than what Yellowstone recorded in 2022. And actually about 1,150 fewer earthquakes than in 2021. So we're on a downward slope in Yellowstone. Okay. The largest earthquake that they recorded this year or last year was a magnitude 3.7 earthquake. The scientists also recorded 24 earthquake swarms, which are groupings of earthquakes that are clustered together in both, like, space and time. And so the most significant swarm of the year occurred a few miles southeast of West Yellowstone in Montana, and that was in mid-March, and it included 138 individual earthquakes in that one particular swarm. The report also tracks, like, geyser activity, which I mentioned, which they say is just really unpredictable over time. So Steamboat Geyser erupted 9 times during the year, which is actually the lowest number of annual eruptions for that geyser since its current cycle began in 2018. But the Giant Geyser in the Upper Geyser Basin erupted for the first time since 2019. So again, these reports are a little nerdy, but it's so fun to go in and look at the graphics and see how things are changing or staying the same in Yellowstone over time. Actually, you can check out the observatory's work on the U.S. Geological Survey's website, and they run these weekly columns called the Yellowstone Caldera Chronicles. And it's very science focused, but it's really cool to, and it's actually, like, given me some, like, sense of safety that Yellowstone is not on the precipice, like, blowing apart the whole world. Like, I feel like I sleep better at night knowing that these kind of, like, fluctuations and earthquakes, they're very normal, and the geyser activity is very normal. And so if you've got a little science in you and you want to read a little bit more about what goes on at the park, it's a really cool place to go. And then we also have the link to this year's report on idahocapitalsun.com.
So, Kyle, earlier in today's program, we talked about the first part of your series that delves into the Idaho Behavioral Health Plan contract. In the second part of the series, you found that an Idaho Medicaid contractor hired 3 state government employees. Can you tell us why this is significant?
Of course. So just to repeat a few details, the contract is called the Idaho Behavioral Health Plan. It's Idaho state government's largest contract. It's for a private company to run Medicaid mental health benefits for around 400,000 Idahoans on Medicaid, and it takes effect July 1st. We learned that the new contractor, Magellan of Idaho, has hired 3 former Idaho Department of Health and Welfare employees, and that includes Magellan of Idaho's new CEO, David Welsh, who evaluated bids for the contract and gave Magellan the second highest score. State officials say they're confident no laws were broken, and they say that Idaho law doesn't block state employees from working on contracts. Following our reporting, the Idaho Statesman said this illustrates the need for Idaho It's commonly called revolving door legislation. Idaho is one of seven states without regulations for around this area that regulate state employees later working on contracts. And I guess a bit more context, the contract rollout was already pushed back last year from starting in March of this year to now starting in July. But I should also say that that even without Magellan of Idaho's new CEO's evaluations for the contract, state officials say that the contract outcome wouldn't have changed. Magellan had the highest score, but actually another bidding company, Beacon, initially had the highest score, but state officials disqualified them for the contract because they said they did past work that was related to the contract. None of the contract evaluators ranked Optum, which the company that held the contract for a decade, in first place, and state officials state contract officials in the Idaho Department of Administration said they told contract evaluators who judged these bids that they'd be disqualified from judging bids if, during their bid reviews, they were or intended to get a job with the bidder. And they say they didn't have information to suggest that.
Mm-hmm. So again, though, Kyle, this whole system goes into effect July 1. And then basically after that point, I guess we all kind of wait and see how it rolls out and how it impacts Idahoans who are on Medicaid.
Yeah, I'm very interested in connecting providers about how this contract rolls out. Please feel free to reach out to me. And I guess something I didn't mention before is state officials say that in Idaho, these kind of moves from government positions to private positions aren't unusual, and they say they're helpful in Idaho's limited market with limited expertise. One lobbyist said that these moves are sort of the nature of the free market. And he said he'd prefer having the smartest people working on these programs than people who weren't involved.
Yeah, fair enough. Sydney, we've only got about 2 minutes left, but I want to end with a little taste of Texas coming to Meridian. There's a new barbecue restaurant opening.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're not hungry yet, you're going to be after this. Tanya Chandler is opening a Texas barbecue restaurant called Smoke and Iron Barbecue. It's slated to open on Tuesday, and she is pulling out all the stops. She's a native Texan, and she has like years and years of restaurant experience, and she's bringing her recipes from growing up, from being, you know, in the restaurant industry, and she's bringing it all to Meridian. She's worked with but local butchers to get a special blend for her sausages. She's pulling out all the stops. She said that she's got one last rodeo in her, and this is it, and she wants to do it right. So she's what you can expect is very traditional. Salt, pepper, smoke, and a little kick is the flavor profiles, what she told me. And you can get everything from, like I said, the sausage to brisket to pork to even what she said is called a loaded barbecue potato.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, hey, everyone, thank you so much for taking time out of your Friday to come on the show. Really appreciate it. We've been talking with Sydney Kidd, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Kyle Fonenstil, reporter for Idaho Capital Sun, and Logan Fitting with Idaho Report. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.